Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We're glad you're with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit, we'll learn about the Kelly Slough National Wildlife Refuge. We'll have an episode of Our Living Lands and one of our own podcasts in session. And we begin Main Street today with Tom Sawyer. Tom's the president and developer of Grand Sky, the nation's premier uncrewed aircraft systems flight operations center, now celebrating its 10th anniversary. It's based in Grand Forks, and under Tom's leadership, Grand Sky has helped position North Dakota as a leader in aerospace innovation, attracting top companies and securing major investments with over $159 million in private investment and a $4.81 return on every $1 of state support. Grand Sky continues to drive economic growth. Tom joins us to discuss its impact and future. Tom, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you very much for having me. It's really great to be here.
Tom, you're celebrating your 10th anniversary. It really goes back farther than that. What was the original vision for Grand Sky, and how has it evolved now over the past decade?
You know, when we go all the way back to the original vision was conceived in 2011, actually. And so we've been kind of working on the concept of, and then ultimately the development of Grand Sky for 13 years now. The original vision was set to, we were invited to participate in developing this vision by Grand Forks County. They were very concerned about what was happening at Grand Forks Air Force Base. Base realignment and closure had meant the air refueling tanker mission at Grand Forks Air Force Base was realigned away, and in its place came these newfangled inventions called Global Hawks. These uncrewed aircraft, the Global Hawk, were moving in, and people didn't know what to make of them. There used to be lots of tankers, and now there's only about 10 Global Hawks. There's no pilots in them. There's no air crew in the aircraft. They're uncrewed completely. You fly them from the ground. So fundamentally, Grand Forks Air Force Base went through a massive downsizing, and the community was scared. They were scared they were going to lose the rest of their base. They were really apprehensive about what the future held for the base. And they came up with the idea that they needed to make investments in the Air Force, investments in Grand Forks Air Force Base as a community, so that the Air Force would recognize the real value of the base and start to think about how to move other missions to the base, how to bring the tankers back, which was never really going to happen, but you try. And so the vision of all this was about how do we preserve the economic vitality of the community as it's affected by Grand Forks Air Force Base. Starting then in 2011, we started working on a plan of, hey, why don't we build out a business park on the base, doing things like the Air Force is doing, particularly uncrewed aircraft systems. And the Air Force said, I'm simplifying a conversation that was 2 years in the making.
Sure.
But ultimately, the Air Force agreed that this was a good idea. And they turned around and said, yeah, let's do this. The rest is history.
Tom, what makes Grand Sky so unique compared to other UAS aerospace hubs?
There really aren't that many UAS hubs, any UAS parks like ours. There's a few. Things that make us different are our relationship. So the way we engineered the development of Grand Sky was to utilize as much as we could the existing Air Force Base assets, the runway, support from the tower for air traffic management and ground management, their existing emergency services for aircraft from fire to ambulance to the security that the Air Force Base provides. So we didn't have to reinvest in those things. We were able to create an agreement with the Air Force that allowed us to utilize those assets. So right out of the gate, we are working with a 12,351-foot runway that the Air Force maintains and we get to use. We pay a small monthly fee to use it. That's a unique asset. There are not too many business parks that have that kind of a runway available to them. We were the very first civilian entity to get access to a Department of Defense-owned and controlled radar that lets us see all the airspace and keep the drones separated from regular general aviation traffic. So those are some of the things that separate us.
Tell me about the public-private partnership. You've described a relationship with the Air Force for sure, and you've touched on other entities like fire and ambulance, et cetera. This is all about partnerships, it seems to me. You really don't own or control things, but yet you have all of this ability to bring together partners. Is that kind of an overview of Grand Sky?
That is. We have partnerships and agreements with a large variety of companies, both private companies and government and agencies, entities. The crux, the nucleus of all our partnerships exists between the United States Air Force, Grand Forks County, and my company, Grand Sky. It starts foundationally with the lease. The United States Air Force leased the 217 acres that Grand Sky is on to Grand Forks County. Grand Forks County turned around and subleased that land to us, giving us both the responsibility and the authority to develop Grand Sky basically on the county's behalf and taking all the risks. So the county bears no financial risk in the project. We take all the risk in that project. For that, we get to be the exclusive developer of the project. So that's the core partnership between these three, the three organizations there. From there, we then have all kinds of relationships with North Dakota Department of Commerce, with the Northern Plains Uncrewed Aircraft Test Site Authority. We have all these different relationships that help us do our job, but all of it derives from the what we call the public-private partnership between the Air Force, the county, and our group.
Account for me the economic impact that you believe Grand Sky has had in North Dakota over the last decade.
10 years of economic impact. It's really a great story that we have going on here. And we need to start out by, you know, expressing our gratitude, our sincere gratitude to the North Dakota legislature, who over 10 years has appropriated $33 million for infrastructure at Grand Sky. So that money has gone to putting in the pipes and the wires, all the utilities, the roads, the security around the park, the helping to improve our ramp areas and taxiways for aircraft. All that money has gone to that. And that money has allowed us to leverage and generate roughly about $170 million of private sector investment. So the state of North Dakota has given us $33 million that we have been able to get the private sector to then invest $170 million more on top of it. And so just right out of the gate, that's a huge economic impact just in construction work. That's a huge economic impact in investment in facilities and equipment and capabilities there in Grand Forks. But then we also have to look at the jobs. So right now, about 269 people call Grand Sky their place of work every day for different employers. Different companies like Northrop Grumman or General Atomics employ people there. And 269 people directly work at Grand Sky every day. Those people have an average salary. We average up all the salaries, and it comes out to about $117,000 a year for average annual salary at Grand Sky. And all of the economic activity generates right now $2.5 million a year in state and local taxes. So if nothing else changes and Grand Sky has another 40 years on its land lease with the Air Force, so if we just look at, you know, that particular, there's almost, do that math, was that almost $100 million in taxes that we'll be paying over the next 40 years. So that's a pretty substantial economic impact. And we haven't even started to talk about the indirect or the induced impact of the people and the companies that do work with us, from the plumbers that come out and help us with our buildings to all the folks with the copying machines and our network folks and all the people that work with Grand Sky. All of those are economic impacts that are second tier and third tier impacts. So we believe there's a lot of economic impact to Grand Forks, and that impact is starting to spread around the state of North Dakota as we start working with organizations in Bismarck and Williston and things like that.
We're enjoying our conversation with Tom Spoyer. He's the president and developer of Grand Sky. The group is celebrating its 10th anniversary of being one of the premier, if not the premier, uncrewed aircraft systems flight operations center in the country. What's your relationship to the University of North Dakota, Tom?
We have a very good relationship with the University of North Dakota. We have tried to work a lot of different projects, and we provide support to them, and they've provided support to us in a variety of different ways. We've started and stopped, and sometimes we just get ahead of our own selves with these things. But we've started working with some of the different departments on some research projects. We have a great working relationship. We're not currently doing a project right now with them, but we're constantly in conversations with the university about that stuff. Now, we have hired a bunch of University of North Dakota graduates. They train some great pilots. They have a great, strong work ethic, the folks that graduate from the university, and so we're excited to hire more.
What's the coolest thing that you've watched happen at Grand Sky.
The coolest thing at Grand Sky, there's been a lot of cool things. We've seen all kinds of different aircraft take off and land. I think one of the coolest things actually just happened last summer, where we had a variety of different sized aircraft, from the smallest being what's called a tiger shark. It's about a 15, 20 foot or so wingspan. It sounds like a really angry lawnmower chewing up a really loud weed eater. It's just really loud and it's not a pleasant sound. So you hear it coming a long way away, but it's a great research tool. And a company was out there flying that. And so it landed on the runway. Right behind that came in a General Atomics MQ-9 Reaper, which is about a 60-foot wingspan. And it came rolling in behind that. And then not but a couple minutes later came an RQ-4 Global Hawk with a 131-foot wingspan. So kind of think of it like a go-kart landed, followed by a NASCAR landing, followed by an IndyCar landing right behind that, in terms of, with the scope and scale of these aircraft. So that was really exciting because, being a part of creating that demand for runway time, that demand for airspace, and building the procedures and capabilities in partnership with Grand Forks Air Force Base to allow all these different kinds of aircraft to land simultaneously. There aren't too many places in the country where that kind of thing happens. There's actually none outside of a military environment. And even within the military environment, there's probably only two or three bases that would see that kind of traffic flow at the same time. So that was great. And then also happening last summer, we had a company called Kratos that came to Grand Sky to test their aircraft. And so this aircraft is a collaborative combat aircraft where it'll fly alongside a fighter jet, carry extra ordnance or carry extra cameras. And so they wanted to launch it. Now, this aircraft doesn't have landing gear, so it launches from a cart, leaves the cart, and the cart kind of comes to a stop with its own brakes. So it has to land with parachutes. So watching a jet that can fly the speed of sound, take off from the jet drone, take off from the runway, rotate off this cart. I mean, it's more sophisticated than a luggage cart, but not a whole lot more. And so it took off and then it landed in parachutes. We worked out an agreement with a farmer about 20 miles away for us to let us land in his field. And so it was able to parachute land. It was reminiscent of the Apollo capsules coming back in. It looked exactly like that, with red and white parachutes fluttering in the wind as it landed. So those are two really cool things that we can look on.
Tom, does Grand Sky benefit only domestic partners, or do you have some foreign relationships, or is that problematic because of your involvement with the United States Air Force?
I think we will probably not be doing a lot with foreign partners in the future, mostly because as Grand Forks Air Force Base is growing again, new missions are coming, and I think that we will stay more domestic and U.S. Focused. Not only that, I think we will still predominantly be defense-related UAS. We will absolutely do work with commercial folks, but a lot of it is defense-related, so that tends to be a sweet spot for us.
We've all watched on the sidelines how important drones have become in Ukraine and the conflict that's going on there. And I bring that up because it seems to me like they are becoming more and more important in our nation's defense, if you can read anything between the lines.
They are absolutely becoming more and more important. They are both important. There's a lot of beneficial ways to use drones, and they are also a increasingly large threat. We saw what was happening over New Jersey and the alleged, and I want to say alleged, drone sightings. Some of them probably were, many were not. But nonetheless, the fear is there are drones flying over my house. Who are they and what are they doing? I think that in warfare, we're seeing the proliferation of drones, of thousands of drones entering the battlefield, and what they can do and the capabilities they bring. And they've helped a military force much, of Ukraine's, which is much smaller than the Russian forces that they're at war with. And they have, created some parity. We're watching that very, very, very closely in how those weapons are being used. And also then, and this is an area Grand Sky is marching toward very quickly, is understanding what the airspace, what is the battle space that the drones are operating in. We have a pretty good handle on what the drones can do, how much payload they can carry, how fast they can fly, how far they can fly, how long they can stay in the air, how to command and control them, doing all those things. We're pretty good at that right now. Now we need to understand the airspace. So electronic jamming, microwave signals that can take a drone out of the air. So we're moving very quickly towards understanding that counter UAS threshold and what it takes to be able to accurately detect, identify, and then track not just one drone here or one drone there, but all of the aircraft in the air at the same time, and be able to differentiate two or three drones coming at us from a flock of birds coming at us. And you'd be surprised, those things kind of look very similar when you're looking at them on a radar. And so we need to start using and proliferate the use of artificial intelligence technologies to be able to distinguish a drone from a flock of birds. So if we have to take action, we're not shooting down an endangered species or something like that. It's really important to also remember that they also are bringing benefits too. So they allow us to do perimeter security. They allow us to do infrastructure inspections. They help us do jobs that are dull, dirty, and dangerous, and therefore create risks, safety risks for people. How can we use the drones to take that safety risk away? So if I don't have to climb up on a roof to do an inspection, I can send my drone up. I have now eliminated that risk of somebody climbing up a ladder and being on my roof, and I can get all the same information. So we want to use those drones beneficially, but we have to protect ourselves that a bad actor doesn't slip a drone into the drones we're using for good, and they slip one in and use it for bad. So that's what we are working on now.
Fascinating. Tom, about a year ago, you announced Project ULTRA, which is short for UAS Logistics, Traffic, Research, and Autonomy. What is that?
So ULTRA was a name we built around an existing Department of Defense program where they were working with NASA, they were working with the Air Force Research Lab, and they're working with the Northern Plains Test Site to be able to do traffic management. So how are we going to manage drone traffic in the airspace? We have a really good idea. If you want to get in a plane, we know how air traffic control works for people in planes. But how are we going to integrate drones into that? And does drone technology necessitate its own separate traffic management? I don't think it does, but it does need us. We do need to be able to show where our drones are and understand where they are within a broader framework so we can use them even more and more and more. So Project ULTRA was a program that the Department of Defense for a decade has been investigating and researching and trying to understand how to set up systems that can support UAS traffic management. Well, that program never really had a name that we were aware of. And the decision was made, they were looking for a way to scale up their program. And they looked around the country for locations where they could do that easily. And sure enough, Grand Sky, you know, won. Not only did we win, they said, you know what, there is no other place in the country that we can do this like we can do it in Grand Forks, North Dakota, because of the university, because of the Northern Plains Test Site, because of the public-private partnership between the county, the Air Force, and Grand Sky, because of all those things, because of nearly a decade of work, all the investment in the infrastructure that's happened allowed us to be, candidly, in their words of their own request for proposal, the only place in the country we think we can do this. That's one of the cool things you asked about earlier is that particular aspect is, hey, we built something that no one else has. And so as we go through this and as we look at this program, they said, we're going to do this in Grand Forks. And we said, you know, we really need to come up with a name so that we can refer to it. So we came up with the ULTRA name, and we have brought a whole bunch of additional companies together to continue working on this program. And this summer, we are going to be flying from Grand Sky up to Cavalier Space Force Station, carrying 50-pound payloads so that we can start to look at how can we move equipment, how can we move medical supplies, how can we do that with drones over a large distance, but in the national airspace. So we've done this before in restricted airspace, controlled completely by the military. No one else can be there, but now we have to be able to do it in the wide open airspace of northeastern North Dakota. And we're going to do that this summer. Our mission is 10 successful flights up and back using our Beyond Line of Sight systems. Again, utilizing all the infrastructure and all the investment that the state of North Dakota has made is going to culminate in these flights in July. And then we're going to be able to help advance the industry even more from there.
I've heard Grand Sky being called the Silicon Valley of UAS systems.
Well, it's actually probably, it's not just Grand Sky. It refers to pretty much everything going on in the Grand Forks area with the university, with the test site, with all the private companies that exist there and the partners that we have at Grand Sky. We are certainly one part of that ecosystem. We like to use that word, the Grand Forks UAS ecosystem. It's kind of a mouthful, but ecosystem it is. And it is not an overstatement in what's going on. There are other parts of the country where there's fantastic work being done. There are great companies. But what you find in Grand Forks, North Dakota, is how closely aligned we all are with each other, how closely we can and do work with each other. So when you come to Grand Forks, you have everything you need from research with the university to getting waivers and authorization from the FAA with a test site to a place to fly your drone on a regular basis. That doesn't exist in too many places in the country. And we have been in the lead on that. And that moniker came up, the Silicon Valley of drones. And so they called it actually Silidrone Valley. But I think it's a good moniker and I think it's accurate.
Looking ahead, Tom, two-part question here. What are your biggest opportunities and also what are your biggest challenges for Grand Sky over the next decade?
Sure. I don't think that they're not very different from what they've been for the past 10 years. Our big needs are going to be capital for development. We need to continue to add more infrastructure. We need to continue to add buildings. We have a unique and very fun problem to have, which is as soon as we finish building a new building, it's 100% leased, and I've got to start pulling another building together. And that's not very common in the real estate industry, but they fill up very fast. And so bringing capital together to build more buildings and make more space and more amenities available for the customers that want to come to Grand Sky, the customer base is growing. More and more companies are interested. So our ability to put money together more quickly is our challenge. And then I think as we go forward, I think workforce is going to always be something that we have to pay attention to. I had the privilege of visiting with Governor Armstrong actually just today and folks from the Department of Commerce, and we had a nice conversation about workforce. You know, there are 269 jobs, like I mentioned before, at Grand Sky right now. There are 50 job openings at Grand Sky right now, unfilled, that we need to fill. So of all kinds of different needs. And so I think that hiring people and bringing capital together to be able to meet the demands that the market is putting on us are our two biggest challenges.
My guest today has been Tom Sawyer. He is the president and developer of Grand Sky, the nation's premier uncrewed aircraft systems flight operations center, now celebrating its 10th anniversary. Tom, congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thank you for letting me spend time with you today. I really appreciate it.
Still to come on Main Street, we'll learn about the Kelly Slough National Wildlife Refuge near Grand Forks. We'll have an episode of Our Living Lands, one of our podcasts, In Session, and much more. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Kelly Slough National Wildlife Refuge, west of Grand Forks, provides vital wetland habitat for migrating birds and offers limited but excellent birdwatching opportunities with nearby wildlife areas and e-bird resources, enhancing the experience as we learn in this Natural North Dakota essay by Chuck Lura.
Located 7 to 8 miles west of Grand Forks on Highway 2 and a couple miles north is Kelly Slough National Wildlife Refuge. It's well known to area bird enthusiasts as being a great place to do some bird watching, particularly during the spring and fall migrations. So depending upon weather, bird watching should be quite good from around late March through May. According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service website on the refuge, it was established back in the 1930s to develop and manage systems of wetlands and grasslands unique to the Red River Valley. The Red River Valley is one of the most intensively drained and farmed areas in the nation, so marshes and associated habitats are in short supply. As such, the refuge provides important stopover areas for migrating birds, particularly waterfowl and shorebirds, to rest and stoke their biological furnaces before continuing their migration. Species observed on the refuge just last year include trumpeter swan, great egret, Hudsonian godwit, ruddy turnstone, American golden plover, and buff-breasted sandpiper. The refuge consists of a little over 1,200 acres of wetland and upland habitats. Unlike some national wildlife refuges in the state, most of this refuge is closed to visitors to protect the wildlife. There is, however, a parking lot and a short trail that leads to a viewing deck that provides good viewing of the birds and perhaps other wildlife. It should also be noted that adjacent and nearby are several WPAs, waterfowl production areas, that are managed by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as wildlife management areas managed by the North Dakota Game and Fish Department. If you're interested in birding, do yourself a favor and check out the eBird website on your computer. It's a website dedicated to birds and birdwatching and managed by the Cornell University's Lab of Ornithology. I found it to be a helpful source of information for anyone interested in birds and birding. The site can serve both a novice and expert birding enthusiast in a variety of ways. Users, for example, can post bird sightings and keep track of their species lists. What I find particularly helpful is that a user can explore bird sightings in a particular area, for example, by state such as North Dakota, or by recent reports by location. One can also search by species. I've put links to information on Kelly Slough and eBird, including a list of species observed on the refuge along with the text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
That was Chuck Lehrer with a Natural North Dakota essay. Lehrer was a longtime biology professor at Dakota College at Botano, publishing research on ecological aspects of grasslands in the northern Great Plains. In retirement, he continues to share his Natural North Dakota essays for the Prairie Public audience.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck. Buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
Hey, how's it going? You are listening to In Session, Prairie Public's weekly look at the 69th legislative session in Bismarck. I am Eric Dethridge.
I'm Ann Olquist.
And I've been in North Dakota now for 10 years, and one thing that has struck me this legislative session, it's how much the Legacy Fund has come up as a potential way to pay for things.
I've noticed that too, and in particular, I mean, right out of the gate with Governor Armstrong's proposal to provide property tax relief.
Second, our plan will use a dedicated stream of legacy fund earnings to provide additional funds to the primary resident credit. This stream will grow as the fund grows, giving every North Dakota homeowner a direct stake in the overall success of the legacy fund.
So that part about people having a stake in the legacy fund sounded a lot like another governor.
Every Alaskan now has a sense of ownership.
On this week's episode of In Session, we're going to look at how the bush rat governor of Alaska, self-described, brought to life an idea to create that sense of ownership over its oil wealth.
Eric, you know, the national news has been breakneck, but this caught my ear.
We're going to have a sovereign wealth fund, which we've never had. We have a lot of things that create wealth, and you're seeing that.
So let's back it up just a little bit if we can. North Dakota has a legacy fund. President Trump is talking about creating a sovereign wealth fund. So, Ann, what are these funds?
So they're investment funds owned and managed by a state or a nation The largest sovereign wealth fund in the world is Norway's.
And I imagine that might have something to do with Norway's considerable oil and gas sector.
Yeah, the idea was to create a fund that protects the country from oil's boom and bust periods.
Like a reliable revenue stream and a rainy day account?
Exactly. And about 10% of Norway's economy comes from their sovereign wealth fund.
So we have a legacy fund in North Dakota that currently sits and earns interest. How does it compare to Norway's fund?
North Dakota's fund is about $11 billion. Norway's fund is almost $2 trillion. That's with the T. But you have to remember, Norway's been socking away its gains from oil and gas for about 50 years. North Dakota's a relative newcomer to the sovereign wealth fund community.
Okay, so the question I've had about the legacy fund is, what are we doing with it? And it seems like this year's legislative session, we're hearing a lot more about what to do with the legacy fund, especially around property tax relief. And the way I understand it, Ann, the governor's proposal is that over time, the earnings, not the principal, but the earnings from the legacy fund will pay for everyone's property taxes. It almost sounds like getting a check from the state of North Dakota to pay your property tax bill, essentially.
It's a similar concept that Alaska grappled with when it was going through its oil boom.
Alaskans get a check every year. I've always wondered how that was possible.
Enter the star of our episode this week.
Here I come to save the day.
Alaska Governor Jay Hammond.
I hear people say, well, the original intent of the permanent fund's rainy day account. Bull feathers. That word was never even mentioned back then, to my knowledge.
He sounds like quite a character, and I'm just sort of envisioning this. I'm getting a picture of a tall guy with a full beard.
No? He's right out of Alaska Central casting, no doubt. And the year he's elected governor in 1975 is the same year that construction begins on the pipeline.
Yeah, that pipeline, which you might have heard about, runs from Prudhoe Bay across 1,000 miles to get shipped to market. That must have been just a massive Alaskan construction project.
It was completed in 1977. So by the time Hammond was coming up on ending his first term as governor, I mean, he's looking at serious money pouring into the state. Again, here he is reflecting on what he's most famous for, which is creating the PFD.
Every Alaskan now has a sense of ownership, receives a direct, discernible, equitably distributed dividend, and it's become perhaps the most popular program in the state.
So this is the famous check Alaska residents get every year. How does this affect ordinary Alaskan citizens, your John or Jane Q. Alaskan?
So you have to fill out a form. There's some paperwork between January 1st and March 31st. So you find out how much the check is in June sometime. Like, I mean, it's a headline in the newspapers. Like, it's news.
I bet it is. Eagerly anticipated news, to be sure. So when do people actually see the cash?
In October, you can get direct deposited, or you can get a physical check. You know, the older people still like to get the checks in the mail.
Well, I imagine those Halloween parties in October are going to be banging there in Alaska.
And even before that, I mean, grocery stores will sell gift cards for their dividend sales. You can promise a car dealer to make your down payment using your dividend. If you haven't paid your alimony or your child support, the state will garnish your dividend. And it's also become a part of the state's economy because it gets people to spend money. Even the nonprofit sector, you can say when you fill out your form, I want 10% or 100% of my check to go to the domestic violence shelter, the animal rescue, or the nonprofit of your choice.
Oh, okay. So kind of like Giving Hearts Day here in North Dakota.
Yeah. And, you know, getting back to North Dakota, I think there's, as we've been watching the legislative session, there's an undercurrent amidst all of these debates right now about how do we use the legacy fund? What are the policies, you know, to make sure people are getting taken care of, they've got a good quality of life? And, you know, I think this is something nobody talks about directly in the legislature, but again, it's an undercurrent. How do we get people to come here? We've got a labor shortage. And then how do we get people to stay? So the previous Governor Burgum and the current Governor Armstrong are both proponents of eliminating the state income tax. That's, you know, one way to make the state attractive. But it's part of this overall retention strategy. You still got to pay for services.
Sure.
And that's where this debate has come up around how to best use the legacy fund.
Yeah, roads and schools, childcare, you name it. Lots of conversation surrounding that, too. So how did Hammond come to this idea of a check, giving cash directly back to its residents and not using it for something like, say, schools, roads, or in Alaska, even ferries.
So Alaska did do that, and it does do all those things. I mean, oil and gas pays like something between like 80 and 90% of public services and infrastructure in Alaska. But Hammond, he went through his own thought process at the time about how prescriptive the state could or should be how it uses its fund.
What is it everybody needs? Everybody has to have food, shelter, power generation, probably gasoline and so forth. Maybe we ought to parcel these dollars out in some universally required service. But then I thought, wait a minute, you know, your needs are different than his, than hers, and so forth. The easiest way to do it is just give everybody this wherewithal to select for themselves.
He's extremely populist. Let people decide for themselves what they need to spend the money on. But before he gets to that point, you got to understand the political environment he's working in as governor in the late 70s. Everyone agreed there should be some kind of fund. That gets baked into the Constitution as an amendment in 1976. Hammond easily wins re-election in 1978, but there's a lot of concern over wasteful spending and, of course, the allure for legislators to raid the fund.
But who's going to care if there's no dividend that's impacted one way or the other by what they do? And the question arises, all right, now we need $1 billion to balance the books. Should we take it from that $27, $28 billion permanent fund or impose an income tax?
So that's the political pickle of Alaska in the late 70s. But Jay Hammond is very special. The way he thought of citizens was the way companies think of their shareholders and investors. So if Alaska is the company and the citizens are the shareholders, what are we giving back to them? Not an entitlement, a benefit.
Hmm. Well, kind of political jujitsu, if you will.
It's very clever, right? But he kind of had to frame it that way. Very independent-minded people living in Alaska, living off the land. I mean, he came to Alaska so he could fly bush planes, so he could be a bush pilot. Yeah. I mean, like, that's why he's there. It's to get away.
Oh, yeah. It's an independent mentality. And, you know, don't call it an entitlement. You know, it's a bootstrap sort of mentality. We recognize it here in North Dakota. But a benefit, I think, is a better word that resonates more. It's that homesteader mindset that we definitely have here in the Peace Garden State.
It's a very powerful cultural narrative about who they are. You don't get handouts. You work hard. So Hammond crafts this idea of a dividend, a check that's a benefit of being a resident of Alaska.
So, Ann, let's bring it back here to North Dakota and the current debate over using the legacy fund earnings to pay for property tax relief. It is similar to Alaska, but it falls short of democratizing the wealth of the fund at the same level that it is in Alaska.
Yeah, and I mean, and Alaska is very special that way. It's the only place that does this. So I was steeping myself in the archive of Hammond's life, and I was struck by this particular argument, that the dividend, it's a check on the legislature.
But if your dividend went down in the same time, the way those people spent that money, the public would rise up in outrage. That's why you have to have a dividend program to protect the permanent fund.
And Hammond was very proud that the dividend fund was internationally recognized as one of the smartest uses of a sovereign wealth fund.
Yeah, it's a check against the legislature raiding the wealth of the state, almost like another arm of government, if you will. And I can see how attaching property tax relief to how earnings from the legacy fund is spent is kind of a variation on that. Like Governor Armstrong said in his initial proposal, it gives people a stake in what happens to the legacy fund. So I got to ask you this question. It's been rolling around in my mind this whole time, man. What do you think Jay Hammond would make of North Dakota using the earnings to address property tax relief here?
I was thinking about that, you know, writing about the governor, reading his memoirs. I think he would say that North Dakota has learned some of the lessons of Alaska, like changing how much of the principal can be spent by the legislature. Voters approved a constitutional measure last year to reduce it to 5%.
Uh-huh.
On the idea of using the earnings for property tax relief, I think he would say it doesn't go far enough. It only helps a particular group of people, homeowners.
Not renters.
And that to have a true check on the state raiding the coffers, you need that balance of power of people feeling the direct benefit when politicians start messing with their benefit come election time. Every person, not just one group of people. But Jay Hammond would have approved of anything that would, in a phrase, diaper the devil.
Oh, there's a visual right there. And diaper the devil. Whatever does that mean?
The last book he wrote, published after his death, was called Diapering the Devil. And he called it that because it's a phrase a Venezuelan economist used to describe all the issues that need to be managed when you're a natural resource extraction state.
Or country, in the case of Venezuela, a big petrochemical state.
Corruption, mismanagement of funds, wasteful spending, lack of transparency. Having a benefit for everyone is a way of putting a diaper on the devil that is managing the wealth from oil and gas.
And we are at the end of our episode, that time when we look at three numbers from the last week.
56. That's the percentage of North Dakotans polled who support the Supreme Court ruling allowing same-sex marriage. And that polling was done by the North Dakota News Co-op.
Sticking with the co-op's polling results, 63%, as in 63% of those polled said they didn't know how much or anything about Governor Armstrong's proposed tax relief plan. That's why we're talking about it, Ann.
And for our last number, to bring it back to the star of our episode, Jay Hammond, 102. Mm-hmm. And that's how old Jay Hammond would be if he were alive today.
Well, that is our special episode for In Session about Alaska's permanent fund and the incredible true story of the Bush Rat Governor, Jay Hammond, who had a unique vision for what to do with oil wealth. I'm Eric Etheridge. We'll see you next week.
I'm Ann Olquist.
The Fargo Moorhead Symphony Orchestra presents Masterworks 4, Bliss, featuring Sonia Bosca Harrison, Saturday, March 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, March 16th at 2 p.m. at NDSU's Festival Concert Hall. Tickets at fmsymphony.org.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous musicians are using heavy metal to express their feelings about climate change and colonialism. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke with Grist reporter Taylor Stagner about some of the music that embodies that connection.
Could you explain what inspired you to write this story and the connection between Indigenous metal and climate change?
I'm hesitant to say that metal is a wholly violent genre or angry, but I would say that I think Indigenous people are angry for many good reasons, and we don't have too many places to show that or to feel those feelings. So I think for me, it was trying to explore that because I feel it's something we don't really get to talk about, but you know, I feel like there's a real rage that comes with some of the things that we talk about when we talk about the destruction of our plants and four-legged relatives and stuff like that. There's just a lot of sadness, which can manifest as anger. And I think that that's something that a lot of people experience.
You know, I feel like the genre often explores different themes of, you know, like rebellion and survival. Do you see any parallels between those themes and Indigenous resistance to climate change or just like environmental destruction?
Yeah, I do see a lot of those similar themes. I think that there's a lot to be said about just the lineage of metal music, and Native people have been there kind of since the beginning, talking about some of these themes that you see so commonly in metal music. Like Pan-American, Native Front, they do a lot of like recontextualizing of like old battles, like massacres and stuff like that, but also with like a Native like look at the past. And you know, there's themes in all these like more recent contemporary bands, like Black Braid's one that I think a lot of people are familiar with. Deals a lot with like, you know, what is it to like have such reverence for the earth and to be saddened when it's being disrespected so violently, and especially the people who are actually protecting it. They're the victims of violence too.
And so for today's episode, we also will be listening to a few different tracks that she selected for her piece that she wrote for Grist. And so the first song that we have up is...
It's called Selfish Man by Winterhawk. It's a very interesting snapshot of uranium mining. Many tribes have been adversely affected by uranium mining, and it's interesting that it's part of the conversation nowadays, but it's interesting that Winterhawk wanted to tackle that and to express issue with the prevalence of uranium mining in the 70s.
It's a child selfish man. They say nuclear power is alright, like the light to make the night bright. But it doesn't mean you can have my birthright. Does it selfish me?
And with our next song that we're going to be taking a little listen to is called Greenhouse Effect.
Yeah, this song's by Testament, which is, they're a wonderful band, like a thrash metal band. They're pretty exciting to listen to, very Slayer. But yeah, this song's about how we're warming the planet and how it's describing like really like arid rainforests burning away, polluting the air we breathe. It's a really good song, and the lead singer of Testament is Native.
Yeah, I guess if you just want to share a little bit about your experience in being a part of the mosh pit and how that, you know, relates to your piece.
Yeah, throughout the piece, I talk about my own experiences in a mosh pit and how my knees are hurting and it hurts to go into now because I'm a little older now. But I appreciate being part of a bigger group, kind of swaying with the music, and it becomes a really beautiful dance of sorts with strangers. It just feels a little bit like blowing off steam in a way, and I love that.
That was Taylor Stagner, who reports on tribal affairs for the climate-focused publication Grist. You can check out her story titled Loud, Angry, and Indigenous at grist.org. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Dakota Datebook for March 11th. In the early days, when the West was still wild, stealing a horse was a hanging offense. Justice was often swift and without formalities. As the country moved into the 20th century, motorized horsepower began replacing the flesh and blood variety. By 1913, drivers were speeding down roads at 40 miles per hour in automobiles, while farmers started swapping their horses for tractors. But that didn't mean anyone would overlook a stolen horse. In 1912, several horses disappeared around Wing, and it quickly became clear that a gang was operating in the area. They made a big mistake when they stole horses from the wrong man. County Commissioner John Davies discovered two mares and a colt were missing from his property. Fed up, Davies was determined to catch the culprits. Described as tireless in his efforts, he didn't just seek his own horses, but worked to recover missing horses from his neighbors as well. Davies contacted Burley County Sheriff Barnes, and together they began tracking the thieves. They followed clues, but Davies began to fear he might never see his horses again. The case broke wide open when they got the word that Oliver County Sheriff Charles Herman had the prime suspect in custody. Barnes and Davies rushed to meet with Herman and found not only the thief, but the stolen horses as well. Thanks to Herman's efforts, John Summerfield and two of his associates were behind bars in the Burley County Jail, charged with grand larceny. Their bail was set at a hefty $2,500 each. Local newspapers noted the evidence against all three is so strong that it's unlikely any will escape conviction. On this date in 1913, Sheriff Herman of Oliver County was awarded a $25 reward for capturing the horse thieves. But the story didn't end there. Summerfield pled guilty and was sentenced to 1 to 5 years. However, he didn't serve much of his sentence. In December, he was granted a pardon, effective the following February, when he was released from prison. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota. we'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, computer expert Kate Keene will join us for a discussion about cybersecurity after the recent cyber attack on X, which was formerly Twitter. Kate will provide us with insights into the frequency of such attacks, the risk of copycat incidents, and how businesses and individuals can protect themselves. It's cybersecurity ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.